Lord Thomas Reel 4. Lord Thomas, when you established Morris Commercials, how did you go about getting a design team or people to do design work? Where did you recruit them from?
Well, Morris Commercial Cars had a very good designer called Rose, P.G. Rose, who also had this bent for cross-country vehicles. And he worked in with Martel in the early days. And we also had some ex-Vickers designers. And they, too, had this enthusiasm for cross-country armored fighting vehicles. So it was a mélange. It was a mixture lubricated by enthusiasm to develop these armored cross-country vehicles. And it was something to which, curiously enough, the gunner section of the army, the gunners made considerable contributions, because their idea that if they could have something better than the old horse-drawn field gun with its iron-clad narrow wheels, which and horses that were vulnerable not merely to bullets but could be scared by noises and this sort of thing, they would be that much better off. And so we got a lot of help and a lot of ideas from the artillery. The cavalry, as I've said, didn't take to tanks all that kindly, because there was no throbbing heart or hard-breathing nostrils in a tank. But they did do their best to get the sort of cavalry spirit into the detachment. In fact, one squadron, their leader threw out the padded seat that enabled him to ride in the tank with his head through the turret flap, and put in an actual saddle that he had used on his horse. He said it made him feel at home to sit astride a device like that, which shows that they tried to capture the spirit and mechanized their animal instincts.
Did you, as a manufacturer, then, have specific examples? You actually saw for yourself this problem with the cavalry, say, you mentioned. Were you called in to sort of solve problems that they come across?
Yes, very much so on the service side. We were called in to try and educate the cavalry to realize the difference between a tank which had to be serviced and couldn't think for itself, and a horse, which was a self-servicing animal. And when it saw an obstacle which it knew it couldn't get over, would dodge away and not try to do it. Whereas a tank couldn't judge the difficulties with which it was faced and went blindly on until it broke something, which wasn't very good.
Was this in the late 30s you found this problem? Was it?
Oh, yes, this would be... Yes, you're right, the late 30s. It was a period of education and the development of understanding and that kind of thing.
How did this go about? Did you actually, or send people down to see what problems they were having?
Oh, yes, we used to keep a whole, I should say, a contingent down at Army Fighting Vehicle School, wasn't it? Somewhere near Farnborough. And there was constant interchange between Birmingham and Farnborough, and a very, very, very close linkage towards the end. So we did get compatibility between what the army wanted and what could be produced for them. And as I say, towards the end of the war, there was very good understanding indeed. Of course, the political, at least I suppose it could be called the political side, but no, the ministerial side settled down as the wars developed and D-Day came and went, the Ministry of Aircraft Production, for instance, had been enormously inspired, stimulated, almost made hysteric by Beaverbrook's lashings and vituperations. It certainly produced quick results, but it wasn't something that, as a long-term operation, would have got the most out of the industrial resources that remained. Then there was the Ministry of Production, MAP, with Oliver Littleton, Lord Chandos later on, that did very good work in promoting better production by the industry and letting the fighting forces have what they wanted. I would say that sending Oliver Littleton to be Minister of State, whatever his title was, in Cairo as backup to the Eighth Army was tremendously sensible and really did produce results and made for better quality of munitions coming out of the factories in Britain and a cessation to industry being asked to make what it couldn't make and getting irritated by absurd requests. So, we were a very good war machine towards the end of the war. Of course, one mustn't or can't say it's a pity the war didn't go on a bit longer. Because some of the ideas that were beginning to emerge would have been very advanced indeed. How many of these ideas are now locked away in your secret archives or anything? Sort of, I don't know. I don't want to know. But undoubtedly, the development of the armored fighting vehicle was the result of a great deal of inspired thought and ingenuity. And just as the aircraft industry made tremendous strides during the years of the war, so the armored fighting vehicle, the cross-country machine, developed the pace and to the maintenance, I think, of law and order.
Can I ask you a little bit about, you mentioned that Martel had come to you with an idea right at the beginning when you set up Morris Commercials.
Yeah.
How did that idea develop? This was a sort of one-man tank-wheeled tank, was it?
Yeah, it's a pretty crude device, actually. It started off with the idea of a truck chassis and a thing rather like a big red post office pillar box in the middle, which protected the driver, and he looked out through the slit in which you normally post the letters. It was very crude, but that's where collaboration with our design team, headed by Percy Rose, made the thing into a much more sensible device and got its sense of gravity down and everything else. Oh, no, I've got 10 minutes. Quarter of an hour, that's all right.
When he brought that to you and you saw that idea, How did you then go about the decision of saying, right, we'll manufacture it?
Then we got mixed up with a tremendous argument. Because before we were going to start cutting metal and involving ourselves in any great expense, we had to get an order from the Ministry of Supply or whatever the authority was. And I don't think the Ministry of Supply had been started. It was from the War Office. However, we had discussions with the War Office. Oliver Burden taking a very considerable part in it. And finally we had in order to make, I think it was one prototype. But it's no good ever making one prototype, because you want to use at least five test vehicles before you can get any range of results in a reasonable time. So the argument went long. And then they decided that it would be better to have a two-man tank. So we started afresh on the two-man tank idea. And then, because we were interested in fighting the world as a whole, we were asked to produce a thing called a cavalry carrier. There's this carrier angle comes into it all the time. A cavalry carrier, which was renamed later on as the Bren gun carrier, was a tracked vehicle, very box-like, made by welding straight sheets of armor plate together. And it was originally powered by a Ford V8 engine, because you had to have a short engine so to give as much room in the body as you could get. And we got a really genuine order to produce, I think it was 30 a week of these things, and they were highly successful. And that led us on to the Crusader tank and so forth. And of course, Morris Commercial Cars threw off an offshoot called Nuffield Mechanization and Aero Limited, which was financed personally by Morris. And that became the focal point of these things. Can we cut? Yes, I will.
You mentioned that Nuffield Aero was established. How had that come about?
Well, Mr. Morris decided he would like to go into the aero engine business. And so, again at his own expense, he set up the manufacture of what were called Nuffield aero engines. A radial engine, which was quite successful, but was regarded by the Air Ministry as being too small. I think it was about 400 horsepower, if that. And so he didn't get the order for a production quantity of these engines, and that annoyed him enormously. And when he was asked to join in the Shadow aero engine scheme, which was to produce Bristol-designed engines for the Beaufighter bomber and various things of that sort, he declined. And he diverted his attention to tanks instead. And he set up this company, Nuffield Mechanization and Aero Limited. The Aero was a continuation of his efforts to build airplane engines of what were known as the Lynx series. But using the background of Morris Commercial Cars and the carrier, the Bren carrier, for which the order had been given to Nuffield Mechanization Aero, he put a good deal of enthusiasm into this thing and really got to close quarters with the Ministry of Supply. And it was that enthusiasm that enabled him to develop the Christie suspension for the Crusader tank, which, as I say, was unfortunately powered by a Liberty, an American Liberty aero engine, which leaked oil. But all this enthusiasm, personified by Oliver Bowden, gave a great impetus to the building of armored fighting vehicles, and almost as a sideline, a certain interest in airplanes. And that too had a fact which is worth recording in your archives, because Morris had a blazing row with Lord Swinton, who was Air Minister at the time, over this refusal of the Air Ministry to order the Lynx series of Nuffield aero engines. He had this blazing row and really parted brass rags. But when Kingsley Wood became Secretary of State and was responsible for munitions production, he approached Nuffield with the idea that he should put up a factory for making Spitfire aeroplanes at Castle Bromwich, which was in Birmingham. And so he was attracted to this idea because he asked to do something important. They told him that they wanted him to apply the genius that he developed for making motor cars in quantity to the manufacturing of fighter aeroplanes in quantity. And he got really alight with the idea. And so that came about, and Oliver Bowden was put in charge of it. And Oliver rather, well, he hadn't got time to do both things, the air side and the tank side. And so the tank side came very much under my portfolio. And I was made chairman of a body known as the Cruiser Tank Production Panel. What was a panel? I don't know. But anyway, that was what it was called. And the constituent bodies of that production panel were Nuffield Mechanization Aero, Leyland Motors, English Electric at Stafford, and Rust and Hornsby, I think it was. And there was another firm whose name I can't remember who made the turrets for the tank. And that production panel really got busy and produced cruiser tanks in considerable quantities. And it was that panel that ultimately got on to substituting British-built engines for the American Liberties, and we got some real reliability into things. Meantime, the Spitfire factory was jipped and tooled up and began to produce Spitfires. But as the power delivered by the Rolls-Royce Merlin engine increased thanks to improved technology and research and development work at Derby, so the airframe of the Spitfire had to be altered, and that meant that a lot of modifications came in, and Nuffield got furious about this because he said to Beaverbrook, you can either have modifications or you can have aeroplanes, but you can't have both. So came a dramatic moment in Nuffield's office. I was listening through an extra earpiece on his telephone when Beaverbrook was saying that he must have more airplane, more Spitfires, and must do production in greater quantities. And Nuffield, thinking that he'd got a trump card up his sleeve, said, well, I suppose you wouldn't like me to give up control of this factory, would you? And Max Beaverbrook said, Nuffield, that's a very generous offer of yours. I accept. Put down the telephone. Well, of course, from that moment, Nuffield was thunderstruck, and he retired into his tent like Achilles. And what interest he had then was diverted towards making bigger and better tanks and amphibian gun carriers and so on and so forth.
How was...
How what?
I would say, how was it he had got hold of the Christie suspension? How did he get caught up in purchasing that?
It was on offer by Christie himself. You see, America wasn't in the war, Leasland hadn't started, and the Americans were not very interested, really, in developing a tank. So Christie offered his suspension, his patent, to the War Office, and the War Office contacted Oliver Bowden, and that's how the thing got its production over here. It, as a suspension, it was very good indeed, very good. Spread the load.
They approached Nuffield. Why was that? Did they think that you by that time had got the ability and the capacity to be able to develop this?
Because we told them we had. Salesmanship, if you like, but we thought if we were going to go into this military armored vehicle business, we'd better go into it in a big way with enthusiasm, skill, and determination. And that's how it came about.
With the sort of the Martel, with the Martel armored car, the one that you developed with Martel, and there's the Bren gun carrier and things, how commercially viable were those from your point of view? Was it a good idea to be in there?
Oh yes, when the orders, you only had one customer, that was the government, got orders for the Bren gun carrier in quantities. That was well worthwhile. And the Crusaders and Cromwell and the other tanks, they were good too, commercially. Martel's armored car never was a commercial success. That was the sprat with which we caught this subtle mackerel.